Okay, welcome back. We're going to get started. In the last class, we were somewhere in the middle of the slides on quality of service. I think slide 38 or something like that. Okay, so this class we will continue on quality of service, and we'll also spend some time on survivability, hopefully in the next class after following this one. Okay, so I was supposed to assign a homework today, and I didn't get around to getting that happen. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the homework ready by tomorrow. Okay, it'll be on the web and also on WebCT. Okay, so please download the homework, and I'll try to make sure that the TA also emails you just in case. Okay, and the homework will be due, you'll get one extra day to solve it as well. So it'll be just 1 week. So just a reminder that I didn't print out the homeworks right now, but please look for it on the web. Okay, so it'll be there by tomorrow. I'll try to send you a reminder for all of you, just in case. Okay, so in the last class we were looking at the notion of fairness and how you can achieve fairness by a round-robin procedure, and GPS is just a way of getting bit by bit, or I'm sorry, sort of infinitesimal by infinitesimal fairness, okay? Basically a way of doing round-robin at a very fine granularity. Okay, and what a GPS scheduler allocates is what is known as maximum fairness, and we saw what that was in the last class. So let's go to the slides, please. Okay, so essentially what it means is that you try maximum fairness. The way simple way to think about it is you want to allocate everybody equal fair share. Okay, now if somebody does not use their equal fair share, you take the excess capacity that has been that we have free, and then try to allocate it equally among everybody else. And if there are some folks who cannot, some flows who cannot use it, then you take again the excess capacity and divide it equally. So you can think of it like an iterative procedure which allocates these equally, or in the end the ultimate allocation will satisfy this equation which we put up here. So this equation basically says that find the number F which you can think of as a fair share or a fair allocation. Can we point to the slides, please? Such that if I take this rate F, and if I ignore the weight for a moment, and take the maximum of their allocation or your demand, that is, you get whatever you demand if it is less than the fair share, or you get the fair share, okay, if your demand is larger than the fair share, and you sum it up, that equals C. This is the maximum allocation, okay, and then you can have a weighted maximum allocation that this fair share is biased by a weight of W. Okay, and you can sort of try to figure out what these allocations are for such simple cases. Okay, and maximum is a very interesting concept in fairness, because I mean where we started out was that we wanted to have mechanisms in the network that would provide for some degree of isolation between flows. Okay, maximum fairness is a way of getting some degree of sharing between the flows, but it can also provide some degree of isolation among the flows. Okay, whatever happens, you will get your maximum share. Okay, so so one way of approximating this GPS concept is by looking at bit by bit round robin. That is, instead of talking about fluids and infinitesimal amount of fluid or a continuous abstraction, we talk about a discrete abstraction in terms of bits. So the way this would work is assume that there's a clock which ticks every time when a bit is transmitted, and you define some times based upon that clock. Okay, in particular, you're interested in a finish time of a packet I. So if I have a packet I, we define a finish time of I, we define a begin time of I, and we define what is the packet length of transmission of I. Okay, and there's also an arrival time of I. So the way we define the finish time is once the packet starts getting transmitted, by plus how much time it takes to get transmitted. Okay, that is PI. So this start time is nothing but max of the prior finish time. You cannot start transmitting a packet before the old packet has been finished, comma arrival. If it arrives later, that's when you try to do, and then plus packet finish time. Okay, so you use this finish time concept. So you are assuming the packets are coming off a flow from a flow, and either the packet starts getting serviced as soon as it arrives, okay, or as soon as the prior packet gets finished, whichever is later. Okay, so that's what this max means, and then you look at how much time it would take to finish that packet, and you have a bunch of FIs for every packet. Okay, then what you do is you use this FI as a way to order the packets. Okay, when packets come in, you service the packets on the order of fi. So remember that fi is a target time you'd like to get these packets out of the system. But in practice, when I have multiple flows, you cannot do that exactly, especially when packets are when you have a packet which is a set of bits rather than one bit to be transmitted. So you can assume that a clock will tick when a bit from all active flows is transmitted, and this is what we call a round in a round robin. And then you calculate each fi for a packet when it shows up. Okay, and this is the basic approach. So you try to service a packet based upon finish times. Okay, so when you have a fluid system, you can do this. But when you have a packet approximation, information doesn't come in just pure bits. It comes as packets. That is the basic granularity which you have. So then what we do is we try to approximate the properties of GPS. That is, the main property of GPS is look at the finish times, so the finishing order of packets, and then use that to assign a virtual finish time for packets, and then you order packet based upon the virtual finish time and service that. Okay, so let's look at what this means. So fair queuing is a way of implementing this approximate bit by bit round robin. And what you're essentially doing is you're taking a bit by bit schedule, okay, that how I would have serviced these bits if it had been a bit by bit round robin, and then map it to a packet transmission schedule. So what this means is, suppose I had three flows, a black flow, a red flow, and a yellow flow, okay, and these are a packet of each of these flows. What you would have normally done is you would have serviced one bit of the black flow, one bit of the red flow, one bit of the yellow flow, and then gone back and did a round robin like this till the black flow got over. Then you would service one bit of the red flow and one bit of the yellow flow. Okay, this is how you do. So this is how the bit by bit transmission schedule would have been. What you do is you take the finish time here and then use that to order the transmission times of the packets. So you see that black packet is transmitted first because it has a first finish time. Observe that in reality it finishes faster than the finish time in the bit by bit round robin schedule. Okay, and whereas the yellow finishes later, and most of these finish somewhere in between. Okay, so what this represents on the right hand side is the packet transmitted as one atomic unit, as one single unit, whereas here you have bits transmitted by one. So this particular procedure of transmitting packets ordered by their finish time as though it were a bit by bit schedule is known as fair queuing, okay, or FQ. And if you add weights to this, it's known as weighted fair queuing, and weighted fair queuing is probably one of the most influential pieces of work that have happened in the community, because as I shall show, if I combine a weighted fair queuing scheduler and as a nice component known as a traffic shaper or a traffic conditioner, you can then start having a series of network queues or series of bottlenecks, and still you can offer bandwidth guarantees, delay guarantees, etc. Okay, it's a pretty impressive result. Okay. So this is again another example where we approximate GPS with a weighted fair queuing scheduler. Suppose I had a fluid GPS system. Fluid means not a bit by bit. This is the way you would have serviced it, one piece of the fluid from this big flow, etc. And weighted fair queuing, you figure out what is the finish times. So this packet finishes first, so it is transmitted first in weighted fair queuing. This packet finishes second, so it's transmitted second, and so on. And these few packets, they finish at the same time. You pick them up in a random order, and so that's how the packet finish time happens. So you observe here that one property of weighted fair queuing is that if multiple packets have the same finish time, they will appear in any random order depending upon the implementation. Okay, so you can essentially have a packet burst, and the delay seen by one packet can depend upon which other packets have been chosen before it. Okay, another example of this is, and packets show up, you have finish times of 5, 8, and 10. So the output here would show up as this 5 packet is serviced first, 8 packets is serviced next, and the next 10 packet is serviced after that. Observe that these finish times are not equal to the real finish times, okay, after the service. These are only used to order the packets in the service schedule. Okay. Now, if I had a preemptive scheduling mechanism, as I can have in operating systems, if you could, even though this packet 8, okay, let's see, what is this? Suppose I have flow 1 which is happening, and it has a finish time of 2, and it's, okay, let's, excuse me. So what happened in this, okay, let me absorb this example first. What happened was that there was a packet in service. Okay, it had a finish time of 10. Okay, so just after it started getting serviced, there's another packet which shows up, which is very small. It has a finish time of 2. Okay, so this is what it means by flow 1 is arriving here. If I had a preemptive scheduler, okay, like they have in operating systems for scheduling processes, you can throw out this process or throw out this thing which is in service and then schedule this one. But the way packets are scheduled is that you cannot throw out a packet and schedule, okay? That is, you cannot throw out a packet that is being serviced by the link, because that's the way, that's the nature of a packet. You serve the header first and then the entire packet is an atomic unit. You cannot violate the atomicity. So the fair queuing in networks does not allow preemption, okay? And since it does not allow preemption, and it can have some arbitrary order in which packets which have the same finish time are serviced, okay, so you can have some burstiness in the schedule, okay, and some unpredictability in terms of what your delay is going to be at a bottleneck server. Okay, so what is the bottom line on fair queuing? Okay, why, if I have multiple queues on a per flow basis and operate a round robin on it, the round robin works as though it services it close to, approximates a bit by bit round robin. Why is it good? It's good because suppose I take a queue that is serviced by a simple buffer management strategy called RED in this case. Okay, I've not taught you what RED is, but in Internet Protocols class we cover a drop tail policy and then several kinds of buffer management policies. The buffer management allocation goal there is, when a packet comes, you have to make a decision whether to enqueue the packet or drop the packet. Okay, and sometimes you can do this even before the buffer is full. Okay, that's called an active queue management or an active buffer management strategy. And there's an example of such a strategy. Okay, the queue itself is just a single first-in, first-out queue. Okay, so the so this you can think of as a first-in, first-out queue plus some additional buffer management facility. So there is one UDP flow which does not back off for congestion, and it bursts at a very high rate, 10 megabit per second. You have other TCP flows which are sharing this bottleneck, and they are well-behaved, they back off during congestion, etc. So you see that the TCP flow throughput on the left-hand side here is basically beaten down. Okay, so in other words, it doesn't have much throughput. And all the throughput is grabbed by the UDP flow, this bottleneck. Whereas in a fair queuing system, you provide an isolation between these flows' performance. Okay, this was one of the fundamental premises of QoS, right? Isolation and service differentiation. Okay, so isolation is, you see that the service experienced by any arbitrary flow is isolated by the misbehavior of the other flow. Okay, so this is what you get in a fair queuing system. Okay, in some sense it's fair. Okay, so another way to visualize this implementation is to consider a notion of what is known as virtual time. Okay, so the notion of virtual time is to imagine as though there is this real time T. Okay, and there's a virtual time in the y-axis called V of T. Okay, it's a function of the real time. Normally, if the virtual time were exactly the same as real time, you would have a straight line here at the 45 degree angle, right? But essentially, what I show you here is a linear, is a sort of multilinear curve, which is linear at parts. It has different speeds, okay, or different rates of growth compared to real time. Okay, now if I had, why is this virtual time concept interesting? The virtual time concept is interesting because the rate or the slope of this curve, dvt by dt, okay, is the fair share of this network, or C by N of T. Okay, N of T stands for the number of active flows in this system. So let's look at what this means. Suppose there's exactly one active flow in the system, okay, which means that the virtual time is exactly the same as real time. Okay, it goes at the same rate. But suppose there are two active flows in the system, the virtual time slows down. So you can think of the time slows down because the virtual time is measures how fast a packet is getting serviced. Okay, so since a packet would be getting serviced at the maximum possible rate, if it is the only flow, if there are two flows, it will be getting serviced at half the rate. So it's as though time slowed down by a factor of 2, right? So that is the basic idea here. So essentially you're trying to measure the service rather than measuring time. This is a useful concept because it maps very well into the notion of what weighted fair queuing is. Okay, so if you remember what is the definition of maximum fairness or what a round robin queue does, it takes what is the service received by a flow W, okay, capital WI, between time t and delta t, and divides it by WI. That is, it normalizes it by the weight, and that is equal for all flows. It's called a balance equation, and it's not only equal for all flows, it's equal for the sum of the allocations. That is, if I take the capital W for all flows, that is the sum of all the service allocations, and divide it by the sum of all the weights, it is also the same ratio. Okay, this was the basic definition of fairness we saw a couple of weeks back. Okay, now how can I model it with this notion of virtual time? So the virtual time is a service that a backlog flow with weight of 1 would receive in GPS. Okay, that is the more complicated definition. If you look at this, essentially you can model this as though you're doing a differentiation here. So dwi by dt here, if you just divide this by t and take an approximation, it's, you see that this is dw by t, and which is multiplied by this factor. Okay, so this is just the ratio of wi divided by sum of the weights. Okay, now I can model this right hand side as though it is an integral of the following form. I take this wi outside and take the sum of wi inside. Okay, and so essentially what I've done is, instead of taking the slope here, I'm integrating on both sides for time t1 to t2. Okay, so the question I'm basically asking is, what is the service I've received for flow I between time t1 and t2, and it's given by this equation. And what I do is I take a look at this yellow marked thing and observe that this is nothing but the rate at which the virtual time goes. Okay, so you can visualize virtual time in two ways. Virtual time is the is how time slows down as a function of real time. Okay, depending upon how many flows there are in the system. Okay, and I mean, just a rephrasing of the same thing would mean, suppose this is the rate at which you have service and you take a unit of flow, that is a flow with weight 1, here 1 by W, sigma WI. This is a service that a backlog flow with weight 1 would receive in a GPS schedule. Okay, so this is the, so the, you can just review this as either a mathematical fact or a concept. And let's look at why it is useful. Okay, so this is just a restatement of the same thing, I won't get into. So what you can do is, you can try to implement weighted fair queuing using this notion of virtual time, because now you can start thinking of service as though it's time. Okay, so the way you do it is as follows. So remember that you use the notion of a finish time and a start time, right? So if I have a session J, I have these variables F of J or S of J. These are the start times or the finish times, respectively. And then S of J, if a flow is unbacklogged, okay, it is either the maximum of the finish time of the prior packet or the virtual arrival time of this packet. Okay, so I think I can give you an example of this, probably here. Yeah, here's a little more clearer example. So let's look at this pictorial example, this slide. So I have flows 1, 2, 3, and 4 here, which have all arrived at time 0, and each of them has the same weight 1 by 8. Okay, now if I take the sum of 1 by 8 plus 1 by 8 plus 1 by 8 plus 1 by 8, it is half. Okay, so essentially here the slope of this curve is 2 times c, because it's c divided by, I think there's one equation here, right? It's this dw by dt is basically capacity, or the rate at which you're servicing, okay, divided by the sum of the weights. Sum of the weights here is half, right? So it's c divided by half, which means 2c. Okay, so you see the slope here is 2c, and when this additional flow shows up here, that is the first flow with a rate of half shows up here, then the virtual time slows down to a rate of c, because the sum of all these weights is equal to 1. So it is c divided by 1, which is c. Okay, and then when I think at this point, essentially these flows are being serviced and each of them gets a larger fair share before this flow shows up, and after that they get a smaller fat share after this flow shows up. Okay, and then what happens is at this point of time here, at time 12, this flow gets over. Okay, and again you get back to a rate of service of 2c. Okay, so this is what virtual time looks like. I think I might probably, yeah, this diagram is better. So essentially what happens is that depending upon the finish time, let's see what's going on here, start time, finish time. Okay, utilize. Okay, so essentially what you do is you draw this diagram of virtual time. Okay, this is what the algorithm does in weighted file queuing, and you use the start time plus the length of the time, length of the packet divided by wi. Okay, and that will give you the finish time of this packet. So this would be, this is exactly like what I told you earlier. When you have a packet which shows up, look at its length divided by its weight. Okay, so this is the normalized length of the packet, and look at how much time it would take to service this packet. Okay, and that is your target finish time. So you use these target finish times, okay, as they are represented in this virtual time dimension, as the ordering for your packet. So the weighted file queuing, the algorithm, the way it works is packets show up. Okay, when the packet shows up, you figure out what is the virtual finish time for this packet. Okay, so it's not the real finish time in terms of real time. It is in units of virtual time. That's the only difference. So based upon that, you view that as the index of the packet and put it in a heap. So the heap is sorted by virtual time, and then you take the packet that is on the top of the heap and service it. Okay, so what it means is that the packet at the earliest finish time is serviced at any point of time. Okay, and the rate at which the time moves can change with respect to real time. So this is the only idea. Okay, so I don't know whether I need to tell anything else. Okay, let me ignore that. So that's the basic thing you need to understand about fair queuing. Okay, now the big picture is that fair queuing is a way to manage congestion and allocate the rates fairly, in particular in the maximum fairness sense. Okay, and once you have allocated the rates, you essentially have backlogs in the queue, and then you would try to run a buffer management algorithm like RED or whatever to manage the queue itself. Okay, but this has not still shown you how to achieve exact rate allocations. Okay, so what I've told you is that if I have n flows which come to a bottleneck, I will get a rate approximately C by n. Okay, which means that my rate allocation is still a function of the number of flows that show up. Can I achieve a rate allocation that is not a function of the number of flows that show up? Can I at least get a minimum rate, for example, minimum rate guarantee? Okay, this is what the notion of service isolation means. Okay, so the fundamental goal of QoS is to provide some notion of service isolation and service differentiation. Okay, service differentiation could be thought of as the weight wi, where I give you a weighted fair share, I give you a differential allocation. And service isolation means I want to give you a basic minimum rate. Okay, so you can do both of that. So we'll study how you can put a notion of weighted file queuing along with shaping, etc., to get these guarantees. So this is in the domain of QoS architectures. So probably the most important theorem in this, or the mathematical result, was developed in the late 80s by Parekh and Gallagher at MIT. Essentially, they said that take a network of queues. Okay, these are packets which queues. Okay, and these are not first in first out queue. These are weighted fair queuing schedulers. Okay, so they say take a network of weighted fair queuing schedulers, where you provide this weighted fair queuing for every flow. Okay, so this is that per flow scheduling you provide weighted fair queuing, and then use a leaky bucket shaper. Okay, at the edge of the network, to regulate the input traffic so that whatever goes into the network of weighted file queuing schedulers is a linear bounded process, or a linear bounded arrival process. So it's basically smooth rate, and you allow for a burstiness, a maximum burstiness of up to b. Okay, so you can think of it as between any time t1 to t2, there is a g times the rate, g times the time interval, g is the rate, plus some burstiness sigma. Okay, so this is a linear bounded arrival process that comes into the network. So if I have a shaped traffic that comes into a network of weighted fair queuing schedulers, I can prove two remarkable things. One is that I will get the rate allocation G at every bottleneck. okay, once I've done this admission control. And not only can I give you a rate guarantee, I can also give you a delay guarantee. Okay, end-to-end delay as a pass-through end schedulers. And the delay guarantee is given by this equation, which depends upon the burstiness divided by G. And it also depends upon at every hop you have to be serviced. Your packet size is P. Suppose I have a larger packet, I'll have to encounter a larger delay. Right? So it depends upon your packet size at every bottleneck K schedulers or K bottlenecks. And also it depends upon the service rate of the bottleneck. So each bottleneck, suppose I have bottlenecks of faster service rate or slower service rate, basically I have some issues with that. Okay, so this is the end-to-end. Okay, why is this whole thing interesting? Because remember that in QoS, I said the fundamental problem of QoS was there was two zero-sum games. One is the sum of all capacity allocation has to equal the total capacity. Okay, so the sum of all rate guarantees, or G, has to equate the total capacity to bottleneck. And the other issue, I said, irrespective of what scheduler you choose, the sum of all delay has to equal a constant, right? There's a delay conservation theorem. So now, what Parekh and Gallagher says is that not only can you allocate delay at a single bottleneck, you can take a series of bottlenecks, one after the other, and you can cross even multiple bottlenecks, arbitrary number, but finite number of multiple bottlenecks, provided each of them implement weighted file queuing, and you send in a shaped traffic into the network, linear bounded shaped traffic, and then you can get, you can have some expectation of what is your end-to-end delay. Why is this interesting? Suppose I want to send a telephone call through this packet switch network. I can have some sense of what is my end-to-end delay going to be based upon the number of... it does depend upon the number of bottlenecks you cross this K. It does depend upon the rate of each bottleneck. It also depends upon the rate which you've guaranteed. It depends upon the packet size. It depends upon the burstiness of this linear bounded arrival process that comes in. That is, how much burstiness you're getting into the network. So if you want to have a lid on the total delay at in the network, you do the obvious things. Reduce the burstiness, okay? Reduce the packet size, okay? And increase the rate you allocate, and you also increase the bottleneck rates, right? Okay, if you look at ATM, which we learned earlier, we saw why it was able to have interesting properties. You saw the packet size was fixed and not variable, and it was small packet size. So you can actually build a multi-hop ATM network which can give you delay guarantees, and these would be, it will be much more competitive delay guarantees. And you can also manage this parameter, burstness parameter, by making it very small. Usually the smallest you can make this burstness parameter is the size of the packet itself. So by making the size of the packet very small, you can also make the burstness very small implicitly, because this is usually measured as number of packets. Okay, so this is this can be made small. So this is why the ATM paradigm was interesting. So the basic idea is put a bunch of weighted file queuing schedulers on a per flow basis and use a leaky bucket at the edge, and then you can get rate guarantees, delay guarantees. Okay. So one implicit thing which is said here is that the rate guarantee G is coupled with your delay guarantee. In other words, your delay guarantee also depends upon your rate guarantee. Okay. So there's been a lot of study in scheduling theory to decouple these two things. How can I get a delay guarantee that's independent of my rate guarantee? Okay, so I'm not going to go into the theory of schedulers. In fact, one of the case study guidelines, one of the topics you can study is if you're really interested in scheduling, shaping, and so on, there are detailed amount of papers in that area alone. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention about the case study. we've just put up some basic guidelines and some suggested topics. We're going to be increasing the number of topics, and you are free to propose your own topic. When you want to propose your own topic that you don't like in the set of topics, feel free to send me an email and CC to Umesh also. But there are some basic guidelines on what you should do. Okay, so a case study involves the following idea. It's a study in some, both which should involve depth and some creativity. Okay, so the goal is, suppose I teach you this quality of service and you want to go a little more deeper in some aspect of quality of service, let's say scheduling or admission control. Okay, these are well-studied fields in their own right. Okay, so essentially you should pick up some of the seminal papers or a book or book chapters which explore those topics in depth and say that I'm going to read these things, okay? And you can have some supplemental readings as part of that, okay? So it could be either a good paper or a good set of papers, at least two or three, and or a book. Okay, suppose I want to learn DWDM and I want to study that in great depth, right? perhaps there's no good papers on it. Okay, there might be some white papers. Okay, and there might be some other fluffy papers. Okay, which just talk marketing junk and don't necessarily give you the detailed technical insight. Okay, I'll sort of discount those things. Okay, I expect you to read, well-integrated text, either in terms of papers or in terms of a book or book chapters, which defines your core area. Okay, so the goal is depth. Okay, the other part is, which when I say creative, I don't actually expect you to come up with a new algorithm or some new protocol, but the creativity is in being able to synthesize a field. Okay, so a field grows over time. Okay, just as I mentioned in the earlier lecture, we came up with the architecture called Bananas, where we showed how you can do traffic engineering even without connection, even without requiring signaling. Okay, to do such a kind of a research or to be able to go and drive the field in the future, you need a very strong understanding of what is right there now. Okay, so what that means is you need to synthesize different ideas, break it down into the basic building blocks of that field, okay, and put it together and say this is the field as it stands today. And then you can write a critique of the field and say this field, there seems to be a limitation of this field, this is the way the field could go in the future. Sometimes these directions for the future might depend upon technological breakthroughs, but you can predict what should be the technological breakthroughs that should happen, even though you don't know whether how it should happen. Okay, so this is what I mean by writing a term paper. Okay, term paper or case study. So this is what a case study should be. And what I want you to do is by next week, that is next class, please report your choices for what you want to do for a case study. Okay, the case study, sometimes you want to pick up a topic that I've not yet covered, or you can pick up a topic that I've covered, like routing or like traffic engineering, and essentially go into that in great depth. But you have to define exactly what it is, and you can either use the prescribed case study topics or the ones you want to propose. Okay, but we'll basically interact. I don't want you to choose something that's too wide in scope or too narrow in scope. Okay, that's my only thing. That's why I asked you to do this. And for case studies, if you want to do something a little bit broader in scope, I encourage you to do, maybe you can form teams of two, okay, not more than two, but teams of two, and you can submit a joint case study in that form. Okay, so I can give you some other wild ideas, like suppose you want to do study free space optical networking, you could do a case study in that. You want to go and study all optical networks, you could do that. You could study DWDM, or you could study cable networks, okay, and then study how people are doing cable telephony, how people are doing broadband cable modem, and some of the more detailed aspects of that. Or you can study the telephony evolution and look at how DSL is going to evolve, etc. Even all these topics are possible, okay, so it's up to you. Excuse me, any questions on that? Okay, so we have put up a link on the webpage with the current case study guidelines and some suggested topics. We'll be expanding that list, but you should communicate your choices to us by next week. Okay, so the point I want to make was you could go into the Parikh-Gallagher theorem, its implications, how it has influenced a whole range of schedulers. There are hundreds of scheduling proposals out there, and so on. Okay, so basically what Parikh-Gallagher theorem says is that you can reserve a bandwidth G at a bottleneck, okay, and you can enforce it by using a weighted fair queuing scheduler, and by choosing that bandwidth guarantee G, you also implicitly choose a delay guarantee, okay, and so essentially you can now, even though they are coupled, you can provide bandwidth and delay guarantees, okay, in a multi-hop network, because I keep saying this in a multi-hop network again and again, because if you look at the evolution of queuing theory, one of the biggest problems in queuing theory has been how to analyze networks of queues. It is easy to analyze a single queue for, say, a general arrival process and a general service time, but once you get into networks of queues, you'll have to make several simplifying assumptions to make that happen. Only recently have there been more significant breakthroughs in queuing theory to handle networks of queues, and especially for some specified cases. Okay. So Jim Roberts and at Trans Telecom and his group has come up with some interesting results if you're interested. So there is a modeling and analysis networks course which goes into greater into queuing theory, self-similar process and so on. But there are some breakthroughs which are happening right now in the modeling world. Now these are highly mathematical and sophisticated areas. And so is scheduling. Scheduling is a very sophisticated mathematical area. Should you go in that direction. But the basic schedulers can be understood in the simple idea. All you want to do is you want to provide two things, differentiation and isolation, and you want to provide bandwidth and delay. Okay, it just turns out that the particular weighted fair queuing concept couples both of these, but you can still give guarantees. Excuse me. Okay, now what I talked about are building blocks. Okay, schedulers, shapers, etc. are building blocks. Parikh-Galgal theorem is an architectural result that says that do shaping at the edge of the network, do scheduling at every hop, and now you can get quality of service. Okay, but now we come into the real world of network architectures, and remember the word network architecture means just where do you place the functions. Okay, so Parikh-Galgal theorem gives you a nice guidance about where to place the shaping functions and where to place the scheduling functions. Okay, it turns out that real world is not as simple as that. When these proposals came out, the internet was already entrenched with not weighted fair queuing schedulers, but they were all first in first out, or basic FIFO schedulers, which were there in most of the internet. Okay, and also the internet idea was to have stateless solutions in general. So internal network, except for routing table state, on the per packet or per flow basis, you wouldn't maintain any state. Here, what we're talking about is you need to maintain queues for every flow. For on a per flow basis, you need to maintain state. You also need to maintain queues or buffer allocations. Okay, and then you want to manage this through scheduling policy. Okay, so it was thought that this whole thing was impossible. How could you actually even build a scheduler that can do it? Okay, how can I build a scheduler that when I have hundreds of thousands of flows, can I do weighted fair queuing for per flow basis? And even if I can do it, do I want to do it? Okay, the internet philosophy is to be more stateless. So there was a fundamental disconnect between the notion of QoS, that you wanted to get some performance guarantees of the network. The only way you could do it is with some network building blocks or network functions inside the network, and you don't want to do it. Okay, so because the internet would like to be stateless. So there's been a general trend in the last 10 years to reduce the complexity of these requirements. So instead of having per flow queuing, can I have per class queuing, or for instead of having queuing for some aggregates and then trying to give similar guarantees or some weakened guarantees for the flows, even though I'm doing scheduling in terms of aggregates. So you try to keep some state inside the network or no state inside the network. There's been some proposal where you say you don't put any state inside the network, put the states in the packet. Okay, so this is known as a dynamic packet state approach. And at RPI, we've come up with an method to say that if you weaken your requirements, quality of service requirements further, that you want guarantees only in the steady state and not in the transient states, we can give that even by using a closed loop mechanism. That is just like a congestion control protocol. We can give you quality of service guarantees. Okay, so these are some very interesting directions that have happened. So in stateful solutions, routers would maintain some notion of state, whether it's per flow or per class or some final granularity. And in stateless solutions, you don't maintain any state. Okay. So the advantages of these are, if these are usually robust. Okay. Suppose there's a routing change you want to build very large scale networks, etc. These are scalable and robust. But the problem is that the actual service you get has weaker semantics. Okay. It's not as tight guarantees as you can get. Okay, so whereas stateful solutions can give you more powerful services, better guarantees, and higher resource utilization, but you can also get finer grain differentiation. So you can talk about, remember when I said QoS is better if I can guarantee it to you a priori at the finest granularity, that is at a per flow basis. So you can do that with stateful solutions and can give you much better protection or isolation between flows. But it's much less scalable and robust. So you see that there's a whole bunch of solutions that have been proposed. Among the stateful, you see also it also reflects a time table here. Around late 80s and early 90s, the first stateful solutions were proposed. And then a stateless or sort of partial state, reduced state proposals came in mid-90s called differentiated services. And this is called INTServe, and ATM also followed the philosophy of stateful quality of service. And then in terms of the network support for QoS, round robin and fair queuing were developed in the late 80s, and also buffer management policies are called what is known as a drop policies were developed. And in terms of stateless, people had been doing a lot of stateless congestion control algorithms in the mid 80s, which we don't cover much of in the internet protocols course. There's much more coverage of this stuff. And so we've come up with some stateless QoS algorithms more recently at RPI. Okay. So let's look at the stateful paradigm. So stateful paradigm is very closely resembles telephony. You have a signaling protocol that goes to every router instead of every telephone switch and has an admission control procedure, requests for some resources, gets a resource, it nails down the path by mapping global path identifiers to local labels. Okay, so the only difference is that this is called a virtual circuit, and the resources which you can reserve here might be different from 64 kilobit per second which you would reserve for telephone service. So you're reserving packet-based service and you're not reserving sort of time slots which you would do in telephony. Otherwise, the cost is exactly similar. Okay, so this gives you a lot more flexibility in terms of what you can reserve, but also opens up research questions in terms of how do you admit flows for which you want to reserve a delay guarantee or you want to reserve some kind of a weak bandwidth guarantee or so on. Okay, so there has been a lot of work in admission control as to how to answer this quality of service call that comes to you. Okay, and this call itself can be routed across the network using a quality of service routing protocol, okay, such as PNNI, which we covered earlier. And this process of going through the signaling phase is also known as resource reservation. So signaling semantics, as we reviewed earlier, is very simple. You have a setup that goes in the forwarding direction, and at each stage when you succeed, you send an acknowledgement for the signaling, and then you could crank back and try again in a different path if these resources are not available. So that starts overlapping with routing. And in ATM, people have developed multicast signaling and so on and so forth, but we will not get into that direction. In the internet, essentially, people are trying to do quality of service on the internet. Packet switch network, which was developed for best effort and did not provide quality of service. How do I give quality of service? According to the INSERV model, or what is known as integrated services model, you need a signaling protocol now. Internet did not have a signaling protocol. So there was a signaling protocol developed in the mid-90s known as RSVP. It stands for Resource Reservation Protocol. Okay. And I think we covered this a little bit earlier. So RSVP is an interesting signaling protocol for two reasons. One is that unlike telephony-based signaling protocol, it is not coupled with routing. Okay, remember that routing is a control plane function, so is signaling. Okay, the difference between routing and signaling is that routing could operate independent of signaling in a packet-switched or connection-less network, whereas in a connection-oriented network like extra 25, ATM, etc., routing is coupled with signaling. So the routing algorithm, the PNNI, would direct a signaling call and you could do crank back and then try again, etc. There you do source routing. Here, by decoupling, you lose the flexibility, you lose the ability of defining a source route and trying to send your signaling call on that source route. But you get the advantage that you can try to implement signaling on top of the internet where you do not have a source routing mechanism. Okay, so by decoupling, as I mentioned, decoupling is a common architectural theme on the internet. You also reduce the degree of complexity. Okay, you give up some optimality, but you also reduce the degree of complexity. So that is one thing. So RSVP is, that's why called a resource reservation protocol, and it doesn't even include the word signaling in its title. Okay, so its primary job is to reserve resources along the path that is already defined by routing. So in that sense, it is slightly different from what is traditionally called signaling. So signaling usually refers to at least nailing down the virtual circuit, if not reserving any resources. So there are two functions of signaling, reserving resources and nailing down the virtual circuit. So RSVP does not nail down a virtual circuit, but does nail down resources on the path available. Okay, so the other aspect of RSVP is that it was developed to suit the IP multicast model. Okay, IP has a funny multicast model where it's a receiver-driven model. If you think about it for a moment, it's very intuitive. I mean, when you turn on a TV, you are joining the broadcast. So you are the receiver, you are driving that multicast signaling. So RSVP is receiver-initiated, okay, rather than sender-initiated. Normally, when you say single signaling protocol, you pick up the telephone and then the call goes from you. Okay, whereas receiver-initiated means the receiver picks up the telephone and the call comes back from the receiver. Okay, so you should rather think about it as the receiver turns on the TV and the call comes back to the internet broadcasting station, okay, so that you can have an internet TV type paradigm. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so the another related aspect of RSVP, because it is developed for the internet, is its funny notion of what is known as a soft state. Okay, soft state is different from real state. Okay, and no state. We saw the notion of stateless and state, right? State means I put some memory inside the router, like maybe a routing table, or maybe a resource reservation, or a virtual circuit mapping saying what is the local identifier, like labels, etc. Soft state means that you have something called labels, or you have something like a resource reservation, but it is it's a reservation with a qualification. It has a timer, and when the timer goes away, the state also goes away. Okay, so state which dies, rather than a hard state which needs to be explicitly removed. Okay, so this is the basic idea. Soft state is a state that dies after some time, or a time zone, unless refreshed. Okay, so these are the basic ideas. The way RSVP works is that you have a forward protocol and a reverse protocol. The forward protocol basically goes on the path and lights it up. So it's like turning on a set of lights on the path, saying that this is the path. And then the reverse protocol, called the reservation protocol, where the message comes from the receiver and goes along this path which has been lit up and reserve resources there. Okay, so that's the way it works. Okay, so remember that the signaling protocol ultimately comes at a bottleneck. Yeah, question.
The path that RSVP follows is given by the Internet Routing Protocol?
Yeah.
So what if that path does not have the resources that are required to...
The admission control will fail.
So will it look for an alternate path then?
It can't. So these are the restrictions. So, but think about it architecturally. See, because the Internet is here to stay, and you like to work within the constraints of the internet. Okay, so you're hoping that if you try to implement RSVP, you might implement it on a network where you can have some control of the routing, but you still, from a design viewpoint, you have designed these things. Okay. So RSVP is more used today in a sender-driven manner in MPLS. Remember when we studied MPLS, we studied RSVP as a signaling protocol for MPLS. It was actually extended from its original QoS purpose. Because multicast is dead, it's not yet appeared on the internet. Okay, even though there have been newer efforts to revive it, okay, including at RPA, we've come up with some new techniques. Okay, but I think there are a few more things which need to happen before multicast can happen. Okay, it seems likely that multicast might happen actually at the application layer. You can have peer-to-peer multicast groups, and like Kazaa could become way to do multicast and so on, but it's not really happened at the IP level as it was originally envisaged. Okay, so call admission means that RSVP has shown up at a bottleneck and it's asking for some resources. The way it asks for some resources, it gives two sets of parameters for the resource. It says that here is the traffic I'm going to offer you, and here's the reservation I want. Okay, can you reserve this resource for me? Okay, so the way it is proposed is that the traffic I offer you is given by a T spec or traffic spec, and the reservation I want defines the quality of service that I want. Okay, this is the sort of bandwidth guarantee I need, this is the delay guarantee I need. Okay, and it gives you some flexibility as to how to exactly implement this admission control. It gives you some flexibility in terms of the scheduler you can choose. Excuse me. But it just tries to abstractly define the quality of service. This is the basic idea. So this traffic spec will ultimately be policed at the edge of the network by the traffic conditioners or the leaky bucket, etc. Okay, so call admission control essentially will have this request reply paradigm that every bottleneck it will request with these T spec and R spec. This is the traffic, this is the guarantee I want. Can you give me yes or no? And once you say yes, basically there is a decision process here, and that itself is a whole field by itself. Admission control, there are several ways of doing admission control. And so when you say yes, you have to reserve something. So which means you have to reserve maybe a slot in time division multiplexing, maybe you have to reserve some sort of a weight in weighted fare queuing scheduling, maybe you have to reserve a parameter G. These kinds of things are internal reservation elements. Okay. Now the way you would actually achieve this end-to-end is that you now have a network of weighted fare queuing schedulers. You have senders and you probably have some shapers at the edge of the network. you have this receiver asking for resources, and you set up a share or install per flow state at each of these bottlenecks, and you continue this process as it goes all the way to the sender. This is the idea. So one of the challenges is that you have to first keep these states, you have to maintain these states all the time, make sure they're consistent. Okay, normally one of the problems is whenever you introduce state, you have some additional untold baggage, that is, you have to actually maintain the consistency of these states. So remember, when you learn routing protocols, routing protocol exchange these LSAs and other things, right? So, and they have to make sure that the forwarding table is current. That is an example of a state, a routing table entry or forwarding table entry, which needs to be maintained. Okay, it's like a high maintenance skid. Okay, so you have to maintain the state. That's the idea. Okay, so, and in the data plane, that is, when packets actually show up, you need to provide per flow classification and per flow queuing. For every flow, you need this stuff. Okay, and you also need to do buffer management, maybe, per flow. Okay, usually people don't care much about buffer management, but it has to be done. You have to provide allocate buffers, you have to set up a drop policy on a per flow basis. Okay, so there was a widespread disagreement in the internet community whether this could be done at all. Okay, whether, suppose I had lots of flows, can I scalably build routers? Okay, and the answer was, I mean, people never believed that it could be done. But after mid-90s, there have been developments in the routing community, as we studied earlier, where people have shown that you can actually build routers with millions of queues. Okay, it is possible to do that. Okay, and there are some beautiful papers on this. If you wish to study this area of routing or router design, you can read those papers. Okay, so these came out in 1997, 98 and so on. So, and you need to do per flow scheduling or service disciplines at every node. Okay, so obviously this is not what the internet is. The internet today does not have signaling, it does not have per flow queuing, per flow buffer management and so on. So obviously this kind of architecture, even though it allows for the internet to be upgraded, okay, some bottlenecks to be upgraded first, some bottlenecks to be upgraded later, it adds a lot of complexity, it adds a lot of signaling to the mix. So it's a sort of heavyweight upgrade of the internet. So you see that these are the new things. You need to maintain for flow state, you need to have a signaling protocol that sets it up, classifiers, buffer management, and service disciplines, schedulers. So these are the essentials of QoS. Okay. Now, as we want to simplify this, we have to make some trade-off. Okay. And the trade-off is usually that, let me weaken the service I can get, and then see whether I can get it. So that is the basic approach that has been taken. So we now go to these stateless solutions or reduced state solutions, where can we achieve the best of the both worlds? Can I provide services that approximate what you can get in stateful networks by using stateless networks? Okay, and the answer is, in some interesting cases, you can approach it very closely, okay, by using what is known as dynamic packet state or DPS. Okay, so instead of putting the state in the bottleneck, you can put the state in the packet. That is the essential idea there. So packet itself has a header, right? Header is state. You can, on a packet-by-packet basis, you can change that state, and that's what we do. And if you think about the bananas architecture we came up with earlier, that is an example also of packet state, because in every packet we put a hash, or we put a path identifier, right? So that's, and that path identifier can change it hop by hop. Okay, if you think about it like a time to live field, or even destination address is like an example of a state, but in some sense that is a static state or a state which varies in a very predictable manner. So dynamic packet state is just an extension of the architectural concept. Okay, and another way of doing it is, can you do reduced state services rather than stateless services? Okay, and can you even weaken it further and remove even computation from inside the network? Okay, removing state doesn't mean that you remove any computation from the network. Okay, so you can probably do some computation on when a packet shows up based upon the state in the packet and then determine how to service it. So we have come up with other architectures to do that. So we'll first look at this part. Okay, differentiated services is an initiative of IETF, or Internet Engineering Task Force, to simplify the earlier architecture they proposed, which was INSERV, that was again based upon Parrott-Gallagher theorems. Okay. Now, differentiated service also basically represents a transition from theory to implementation. As people came up with the first theory, people came up with the huge theoretical hurdle and said, actually in packet switch networks you can do quality of service. That was the first thing. And then the next step was you can do quality of service in a scalable manner with tunable complexity in terms of implementation. That was the second goal. And later people wanted to say that I not only can simplify the implementation both in control and data planes, but I can also simplify the configuration and consolidate the configuration at the edge of the network, etc. So those are the kinds of ways in which quality of service is progressing today. Okay, so with that overview, in differentiated services you are interested in scale. That is, can I have more reduced state in the network because the having high amount of state is a huge overhead. And then the integrated services just provided you some forms of services like guaranteed bandwidth, guaranteed delay, but it does not represent the wider sense of differentiation. Remember that quality of service broadly means service isolation and service differentiation. And if you look at the marketplace for other goods, there are infinite ways in which you can differentiate one product from the other. Like I can give you platinum Visa card or gold Visa card. Okay, what is the difference between platinum Visa card and gold Visa card? I mean, what do you really know? So the customer might believe that something is better, and maybe something is better. But essentially, if you look at the finer grained details, you might be giving coarser grained service guarantees. Instead of giving you service guarantees on a flow, you might be giving on an aggregate, or you might be giving a differentiation saying that you belong to class 1 and class 2, and I tell you that I over-provision class 1 and under-provision class 2 maybe. Okay, that might be one kind of guarantee. Or so essentially you weaken some of the guarantees, or you might be giving some of these guarantees a posteriori. That is, you don't give these parameters a priori, but say measure my service, look at how good it is. Okay, so when you say measure my service, it implicitly means that I don't guarantee you anything. Okay, priori. Okay, so these are ways in which the quality of service game is being weakened. But imagine, weakening does not mean the service is really bad in some sense, because the weakest service is the best effort service. It was very, very successful service. So weakening a service does not necessarily mean the service is bad. It just reflects the fact that you're making some architectural compromises to make this whole thing happen in the network. Okay? And you can think of a quality of service as a game between what the network can offer you and what the application can compromise to. Okay? If the application can compromise and become more adaptive and can handle lower quality of service, that is one way in which application comes close in the argument. And the network tries to give you more and more, and at some point both of you meet and you have a consensus and you're able to have these killer applications that come together. Okay. Okay, anyway, so the other thing which DiffServe allowed you was to decouple signaling and also use simpler forms of signaling, etc. Okay, so the model in DiffServe is that it recognizes that there are only two main architectural elements. One is the edge and the other is the core. In the edge, you want to place some sort of shaping or conditioning elements, functions. And at the core, you wanted to provide some sort of scheduling or buffer management functions. This is a clear abstraction of what really happens, right? Now, what you do is, besides this abstraction, you don't do anything else. You say that I give you flexibility in terms of the types of shapers I implement and in the types of condition types of schedulers I implement. Okay? So, this is the idea. And then, as you go from the edge to the core, you carry a field in your header called the differentiated services byte or DS byte, and you use that to select the service you get, or select what is known as the per hop behavior you get at interior nodes. Okay, so essentially what it can do is interior nodes now focus on forwarding and giving you per hop behavior. Now the per hop behavior does not specify that this should be on a per flow basis. Okay, it allows you to have per hop behaviors that can be defined in larger aggregates. Okay, so essentially you have this edge and core. Edge router can do all the complex per flow stuff, accounting, per flow management, shaping, etc. And then you mark packets into aggregates. Okay, either in profile or out of profile based on the aggregate. And core routers provide per class traffic management building blocks like buffering, scheduling. And one example of buffering is that I can give color packets red and green and then give green packets better for service. So you do marking except for the edge and you do scheduling buffer management at the core. That is the only similarity, but you have flexibility in what is the granularity of this stuff. Okay, and in the packet format, you essentially use a byte, 7-8 bits here, and 6 of these bits stand for differentiated services field, or it's called a code point. Okay, that's just a technical term. And it turns out that you can use this field in existing IP packets. So what you do is you take an IP header and look at the type of service byte, which is one of the bytes in the IP header, if you remember that, and you rename it. Okay, you say essentially they're saying this is a way of doing some sort of backward compatibility. All I have to do in routers is to interpret this type of service, which I was not using anyway earlier, as a differentiated services byte, and then I can do this architecture. Okay, and at the edge you have these sort of building blocks, either classifier, marker, shaper, dropper. You see that once you shape, you have some options. You can make the flow, you can make the packets queue behind, or you can send the packets in with a lower priority mark, like a DE bit, like we saw in a frame relay. And you can meter it, basically for pricing, etc. So at internal nodes, you provide what is known as per hop behaviors, which is essentially an abstraction and generalization of the concepts of forwarding, that is switching, and what are the other things you do? You do scheduling and buffer management, classification, etc. So there's just an abstraction or abstract term for that, for all these forwarding functions, data plane functions, which I talked about. So by the concept of PHB by itself does not specify you should implement weighted fair queuing and you should do it on a per flow basis. It gives you flexibility in defining this PHB. Okay, you could do this on a class basis or on some aggregate basis. Like you could say class A gets some X percent of outgoing bandwidth, or you can say class A gets priority over this. Okay, so it gives you flexibility whether it's a sort of a round robin type stuff or whether it's a priority type stuff. Okay, so some couple of PHBs that are under consideration have actually been standardized recently are called accelerated forwarding and assured forwarding. Okay, why these terms? Why are we interested in them? Essentially, what with this accelerated forwarding, you can get an approximation of least line behavior. Essentially, what you want to do is I want to get a pipe end to end, okay, and the pipe needs to be given a bandwidth guarantee and some control over jitter and delay. Okay, that's what a least line is. But you don't provide it at the bit level or the physical level, you provide it at the IP level, that is in terms of packets. But because packets can be a variable size, etc., you have to accommodate a little more jitter than what you can do in a bit-by-bit service. Okay, so that's what I call as a packet-based least line. And the remarkable thing about this is that Parekh-Gallagher theorem required that you needed to do this on a flow-by-flow basis, you need to scheduling. The accelerated services building block, or accelerated forwarding building block, allows you to have an aggregate scheduler. Okay, that is, you can have a scheduler that operates in terms of an aggregate. Okay, and it turns out that a variety of schedulers can be modified to provide this aggregate guarantee. Okay, and this is an area still of intense study. Okay, so there is a conference called International Workshop on Quality of Service, and papers still come today, till today, talking about how to implement this accelerated building block by using the cheaper schedulers, etc. Okay, so this is remarkable because you can now start having least lines or a near approximation, not exactly least lines, on a packet service. Why is this interesting? Now you can take a large network like AT&T, essentially packet-based, IP-based network, and then start supporting phone calls on top of it. So this is considered very interesting and important for phone calls. And a lot of companies are already doing phone calls using this, mapping phone calls on top of this service. And then they need to, for the residual jitter that the packet network has introduced, you need to smooth it out on the other side. So they put some smoothers and de-jitterers at the end of the network and map phone calls or IP telephony. The other service which is provided is to emulate the frame relay behavior. If you remember what frame relay was, it gave you that committed information rate and a peak information rate, right? So similarly, you can have an assured rate or a minimum or a committed rate. Assured is sort of a weakened form of committed, that's what it means. And the forwarding building block essentially gives you that assured forwarding and gives you some flexibility on how to implement it. You don't necessarily have to implement it with class-based queuing. You can do it with just a single queue and there's some fancy buffer management or what is known as differential buffer management. So this is again another area of intense study. There are papers arguing back and forth saying we don't know what assured forwarding is doing and so on and so forth. Okay, so at RPI, I don't know whether I'm going to cover that, but essentially we've shown that you can do assured forwarding even with FIFO queues without putting any buffer management, but just by doing closed loop control between the edges. So if you look at the edge, the model which I showed you earlier, like this edge router and core router, I'm saying that you can take existing IP routers, don't change them at all, and essentially operate a closed loop between these two nodes, okay, and still achieve something that looks like like the expedited, the assured service. Okay, so that's something we've shown recently. Okay, so the other part which we should look at is, can I get a stateless architecture? Remember that this allows you to have a tunable state, or the state is defined at a higher granularity than a flow. Okay, now there was an architecture developed by Ian Stryker from CMU, who's now a professor at UC Berkeley, called SCORE. Okay, it's known as a scalable core architecture. It's also sometimes alternatively called dynamic packet state architecture, where instead of putting the state inside the network, you simplify the network, make it look like a FIFO queue and maybe some processing complexity here, but then put all the state at the edges of the network and put state in the packets. Okay, so edge nodes are here, core nodes are here. The dynamic packet state approach is, instead of taking a complex network like this, you emulate a similar function to the reference network in a score network or a scalable core network. The idea is to have the packets carrying the state. So instead of putting the state over here, you can think of the packets as carrying the state. Okay, simple way of thinking about it. So the ingress node will not have the state. So you sort of tag on the state, like maybe we talked about in bananas architecture, we put a path ID on top of it as an example of packet state. Or here you can put some QoS, you can compute some QoS information and put some state about it out here. And then as you go through the core nodes, you you do some processing here in the data plane, and you might update the state. So from green, from yellow it's turned to red here, for example. So essentially symbolically indicating that the packet state can dynamically change at every hop, and there's some computation overload here on the data plane. If you're willing to do that, then this is possible. Then as you get out of the network, you remove this packet state, and from here to here you achieve the quality of service. A fairly dramatic idea, and he's shown that you can do guaranteed services, some aspects of guaranteed services with this. So essentially you want to create a pipe abstraction that gives you all those rate guarantees. And he's also shown that if I have a simplified network that can control jitter, okay, called as a core jitter virtual clock, okay, I won't get into this details, but it's essentially a simplified form of the jitter virtual clock. It's something like weighted file queuing, but it doesn't manage just the delay and the bandwidth, but it also manages the jitter or the variance in delay. Okay, so this is another class of scheduling algorithms. So you can take a simplified scheduling algorithm and you can do this. Okay, so we've essentially talked about what the network can do. Okay, it's interesting to speculate about what can the application do. Okay, as I said, the application can come closer to what the network can offer. Application can be more adaptive. So what can you do in terms of adaptivity? Okay, here's what you can do. First thing you can do is congestion control. Congestion control is there in TCP, but UDP does not prescribe congestion control. You can add congestion control to it. Why do I want to add congestion control? If I'm a video flow, I'd like to get more bandwidth. So why don't I just throw my packets into the network? First of all, you'll make the network unstable. Okay. So if everybody does the same thing, nobody will get anything through. Okay, so this is the first idea of congestion control. I mean, the basic idea of congestion control is you will have an unstable queue, which will give zero throughput for everybody. Okay, so in more meaningful terms, what it means is that congestion control allows you to have some say in which of your packets are going to be dropped. If you let packets go into the network will drop it without consulting what you want to get dropped. So when there is overload in the network, at least congestion control means that the queues will build up at the source. The source will have some control over what gets dropped. So that's the basic idea. So you can do source buffer management, packetizing, marking, etc. to control what gets dropped, and then the residual packets which go into the network, you can mark some packets that are important, some are less important. But essentially what you're doing is you're taking the application level intelligence. Okay, here is my video compressed, and here are the I frames, here are the P frames, this is more important than the other. You're taking this knowledge and mapping it to a bit. Okay, this is what you're doing. Or you're mapping it to a packet header field. So in the packet header field, you can basically distill and take the essence of application intelligence and map it to that. That's what you can do with this. The other thing you can do, of course, is some fancy video coding. Okay, and there is a new Indian media coding known as unequal error protection. Okay, what it means is that even if I have the internet which gives me best effort service or undifferentiated service, I can actually create artificial differentiation on top of it. How? By taking my more important packets and protecting it more, by protecting it with error coding, and my less important packets I don't protect. So this is what is called unequal error protection. So what happens is that if packets are dropped inside the network, I will be able to recover my more important packets, but I will not be able to recover my less important packets. It does not give you delay guarantees, it actually adds overhead, etc. But then it gives you an equal degree of protection, and therefore it is giving you some differentiation. So essentially you are taking a best effort channel and you are engineering a better than best effort channel. Purely the end systems. Okay, it's quite remarkable to think about it. Okay, so now with Bananas architecture, we've shown that in a connectionless network you can have multiple paths. So you can use unequal error protection on a path basis also. You can send packets in one direction, unequal error protection on another direction, etc. Okay, these are areas under current research. Okay, so this is what you can do in end-to-end. Okay, and the framework for doing this is a protocol known as RTP. RTP it has this unfortunate name, real-time protocol. It has nothing to do with real-time. Okay, so essentially it's a transport protocol. It's like it adds value to UDP. Okay, UDP is a protocol that is a basic transport protocol. It just gives you a port number and then it gives you some error checking. Okay, whereas in RTP you can add some extra fields like a sequence number, a timestamp, and some more information. In fact, another basic idea of RTP is that your application can customize the RTP header. Okay, this is known as application level framing. Application can distill its own intelligence by designing its own header as an extension of transport level header. Okay, so this is a fairly revolutionary idea in RTP, which was developed in the early 90s. Okay, so the sequence number timestamp, why is it interesting? Packets may be misordered in the network, but when it comes to the other side, you can reorder it at the application side. Okay, and you can put it in a buffer, and you can put a playout buffer at the receiver side, which masks out some of the delay variance of the network. Suppose the network has delay variance, that is jitter as it's called, and you build up some queue at the receiving side and then start playing it out at a constant rate. So that way you can mask out some of the delay variance, you can reduce the variance seen by the application. So you don't have to see the sort of stop and rebuffering which you see sometimes in real audio or real video when you see. Okay, but that you should realize is that it's done even after buffering. Okay, so that's the residual thing. So the internet actually has a lot more variance, and you're able to mask out some of the variance from applications. Okay, timestamp also allows you to sort of synchronize audio and video. You can send audio streams, video streams separately, and when packets show up at the other side, you can use the timestamps to synchronize them, etc. Or if the timestamp also says that if a packet is too late, you can throw it away. Okay, and there are some other fields here which will not go. So the way RTP works is it has also a small control plane. It's also designed to support unicast and multicast, because future TV and those kinds of applications are likely to be multicast. Internet radio, for example. So unfortunately some of those things have not yet succeeded, so you have not yet seen internet TV and internet radio, but you can still go to CNN.com and get, and you can subscribe to their streaming service, but still that's delivered to you point to point. Okay. So it provides a control protocol where the receiver can identify some statistics over 5 minutes, etc., and send it back to the sender to tell the sender how its received quality is, etc., so that you can then do some adaptation based upon that. Okay, that's all RTP is. RTP is a very lightweight protocol that gives you some extra degree of freedom on top of what UDP can do, and it gives you a basic function which can be customized by the application. Okay, which can then do source buffer management, it can then do unequal error protection, etc., congestion control and so on. RTP doesn't even specify congestion control. So for example, in a real, suppose you want to do video streaming or audio streaming on the internet, this is how it works. You take RTP, okay, and then you also have another protocol called RTSP. Okay, RTSP is a protocol that gives you the same controls that you would find a VCR. So in a VCR you say play, you'll have a play button, right, and you'll have a rewind button and so on, right. So you want to get this function, RTSP basically gives you the capability to do that. Okay, and then it essentially does things like decompression, jitter removal, error correction and so on, and the GUI for user control gives you the same abstraction as though you would get in a VCR. Okay, the way it will work in a streaming server, essentially you'll have a web server which normally operates using HTTP, you have a web browser here, And then locally you might have a helper application called a media player, or Real Audio, or maybe QuickTime, far better than all of these stuff. And then essentially you use a streaming, you connect to a streaming server. The web server might be different from a streaming server. So today companies like Akamai are hosting the streaming servers close to you, and you can, even though you access the content from some web server far away, the actual data might be streamed to you. So this then can be called the control plane, and this is the data plane of this function. Okay, and on the receiver side, you can put a buffer, you can do some jitter removal, etc. So, and this, the way the buffer operates, essentially, this problem, normally in a buffer management, you don't want the buffer to overflow. In this case, you have a funny problem of you not only want it to overflow, but you don't want it to underflow as well. Okay, if it underflows, suddenly you will have to stop and rebuffer. Okay, so this is the problem. So the whole goal of this buffer is to reduce jitter and so on. Okay, today if you look at Apple's QuickTime, it has an interesting thing that it uses the entire disk as a buffer. So there's an unlimited amount of receiver playout buffer. So it allows you to have a hybrid paradigm between download and streaming. Streaming doesn't mean that you just have a finite buffer, you can have an infinite receiver buffer. And this is a kind of, if infinite receiver buffer is also seen in TiVo, if you have used, it's a kind of a way of doing interactive TV. Okay, so essentially you can stop and control and fast forward ads and do other things. Okay, you can rewind TV, for example. So this is what TiVo does. Okay, so we'll continue this stuff in the next class.